for payroll, and it's Debbie McAllister, who is a payroll analyst from Human Resources, who will kick off the meeting for us. And later on, we will have François Pouliot from the Procurement Services. He's a director who will present on procurement services. So I'll pass the floor to Debbie. And she's very sick, and she came all the way here, so, you know, please welcome her with a round of applause.
Good morning, everyone. Payroll, the, I guess, black hole of everything when you're trying to get stuff done. We can talk about a lot of things for payroll, but for today I decided just to do, I just have like four topics for discussion. POPs, because that's, we have a lot of questions about POPs payments. Audit requirements, what internal audit requires that you have in your areas for backup purposes. FOPL changes, which is another big topic, and some frequently asked questions, like basic questions that are asked all the time when people are looking for information in payroll. So, roles and responsibilities. We are all accountable for every POPs requisition or Minerva form transmitted. We must ensure that the roles and responsibilities of everyone involved are respected. Administrative responsibilities. We have a document on our HR website, and in the document it goes through a whole list of information, administrative responsibilities, the system itself, roles and responsibilities of everything that has to be done, the payee, the POP submitter, what you're supposed to be doing with that. And it also has links to Minerva for certain things, and it has links to the financial knowledge base also for articles that are on there. If you're looking for information, it has links to that. It also has a little grid on it with supporting documentation that we need to use. It has an explanation of account codes, and it has also links like to archives, how long you have to keep stuff and everything. So this is on our HR website. To be able to access it, you have to go into our HR website and sign in under HR administrators, and then go to HR POPs procedures, and you will be able to get this document, okay? It's being updated at the moment. I went in this morning and some of the links are broken, so I will correct them by this afternoon. But if you go in and you read this document, it has a lot of information about what you should be doing when you're processing a POPs requisition, okay? Payment types. So I had gone out on campus with Nancy Brose from the Faculty of Medicine. So if anybody went to any of those presentations, these are part of the slides, so they will look very, very familiar to you. So basically, we have different POPs payments. We have the academic casual payments, and there's a drop-down menu in POPs when you're using it. When you click on it, it brings down all of these selections on the side, on the left-hand side. This is what you see when you're doing POPs. Once you go in and you transmit it to Banner, it goes into our Banner collector table. And in the Banner collector table, under a payment type, are all these codes on the side for the Banner collector table. So when someone from our office calls, or if you're talking to someone from our FMS, looked it up, they might say to you it's that the account code doesn't match the payment type. And they're looking at this in the collector table saying SG, and you're saying, well, I don't know what that means. So basically what we did is we wrote down every payment type that is in POPs, and we've given you the translation on the side. So this translation, when you look at it, you can take that and go over to another form that we have on our website, is the mapping of the account codes, and it has all of these descriptors in there, so you'll know which account code to use when you're picking a specific payment type. If you're trying to pay students, it should be for course or research related work. If the individual is doing admin support type work, then you should be using the non-academic payment requisition in POPs. For the research assistants, the graduate and the undergraduate, they have now unionized. Okay, they are covered by the collective agreement by Amur. So if you go to our HR website, all the collective agreements are there. It's probably best to go in and download the collective agreement, because there are certain rules when you're processing stuff through an appointment form for a research assistant that differ from when you're processing payments for research assistants through POPs. Okay. There are specific things that are covered by the Amur Collective Agreement. They are entitled to 4% vacation pay on the requisition itself. Whether you put it in or not, it is going to get paid because it is part of the collective agreement. There is also, if you've noticed, a new charge probably on your ledger saying there's another amount of money, and that's in compensation for legal holiday requirements. So on every paycheck, they get paid their 4% vacation pay, and they also get paid something called LHC, which is legal holiday compensation, and it's percentage, and it changes each year. For the Amur collective agreement, the percentage is, I think, 3.2. That's in the collective agreement, so maybe if you want to just verify that to be 100%. But those are the charges. For the non-academic type, these are the type of payments that we have for non-academics, for the admin support. The clerical and the technical people have unionized under the AMUSE collective agreement. That is also on our website. For them, it's the same type of rules. They automatically get added 4% to their paycheck. And presently, their legal holiday compensation is 2.4, which will be increased to 3% effective June 1st. So any payments you're transmitting now will have a higher amount charged on your fund going forward. So in these collective agreements, it tells what we're going to be charging besides the basic amount of money that is on your requisition that you are transmitting to us, okay? And these are the miscellaneous payments for people. There, excuse me. We have specific types. For the special non-academic payment for a miscellaneous payroll, you have to get pre-approval to pay miscellaneous payments through total compensation, so you have to make sure that you do have approval first before you transmit any miscellaneous payments. That is also in our document under HR procedures. It tells you what you need, what you have to do, okay? For the royalty payments, we also need backup. So if you are transmitting royalty payments either for a miscellaneous or an academic casual, we need backup to say exactly what the royalty payment is for, okay? I've put this slide in just to remind everybody that awards are no longer paid through payroll if the individual is an undergrad or a grad student, okay? Those payments have to be processed through BSEC now, not through payroll. The payments that are processed through payroll and or the Minerva appointment forms are employment type income, okay? Teaching assistant, research assistant, all the work study stuff that goes through POPs is for work performed, so it's employment income. The only exception to that is for postdoctoral fellows. Those awards have to be processed through payroll because the federal government now requires us to take taxes off of those payments for the individual. So whether you're making an appointment form, a Minerva appointment form for an award for a postdoc, or you're paying one through POPs, through payroll, they have to go through POPs for postdocs. All the other ones have to go through BSEC, and we've put a link there for the administrative toolkit for any information that you need for payments that are being processed through BSEC. Things to remember. Titles. In the title area, we see all sorts of stuff in there. NRC 55, JK, I know you all know what that means. But when the auditors come in, they don't understand what that means. And we don't know what type of duties the individual is performing. So don't make up titles. When you have someone working for you, you basically know what type of work they're doing. If they're a clerk, put clerical, technical, put something in. Just because it belongs to a professor, we see Professor Johns. I'm like, okay. That doesn't help us in identifying what type of work the individual is performing at the university. For research assistants, you always have to remember to put RAU 13 on all of the requisitions that you're paying for a research assistant. And you have to remember to be very careful in the drop-down menu to pick the proper selection, undergraduate research assistant, graduate research assistant, or just the academic payment because they're not a student at McGill University. And also for invigilators, we need you also to type in the title invigilators. And invigilators are paid on the academic casual requisition, not on the non-academic, okay? And they are in the process of unionizing also. Right now, they're still negotiating with the university. For students, to make sure that they are a student, to be able to use the student-type payments in POPs, you should be verifying that they are full-time students at McGill University, okay? To make sure that we are paying student-type payments for a student that does go to McGill University, okay? Salary account codes. People seem to have difficulty deciding what account code to use for what payment type. The account code definitions are on the knowledge base, so if you want to know what the account code is used for, if you go into the financial services knowledge base, they have all the definitions there for you. And it basically says this should be used on an appointment form only, on a Minerva appointment form only. So please don't use those on POMPs because they come up in an edit report and then we have to contact the department. Sometimes we contact the department. If you've contacted them once or twice and they're still doing the same thing, we do not call back anymore and we automatically change it. So if you go in and wonder why it got changed, there's either a note on the bottom or there's something up near the comment area that has this, we did it systematically. There's a little kind of comment in there to say, so you'll know that we did change it. You might have transmitted under one code. We have now changed it to another one. The mapping of the account codes is the is a report that we have made to say these are the payment types and these are the only account codes you can use for these payment types. And that's the reason they do get changed, okay? And the POPS collector table. We've had problems in the past that people have thought that they transmitted the forms into POPS and they didn't end up there, so the individuals did not get paid. Or they thought it didn't go because there was a little glitch and they pressed and sent it twice, and then they end up with, like, you know, not 50 payments, 100 payments. Yeah. And basically, we have an edit report for that. We find out before the pay is run. We call you up, and we say you have to go into the collector table and delete them all manually 50 times. So just be very, very careful that if you do think there was a problem, well, when you transmit any POPS forms, you should be transmitting them and then going into the collector table to see that they made it there. That's the rule of thumb. For sure, you should be going into the collector table and making sure that they have made it there. That way, there won't be any problem with it being paid. Also, when you're transmitting, we have specific deadlines that are on our website. If you could please abide by those deadlines. We do send out reminders if they have shifted. People still do not abide by the deadlines. And sometimes we can fix it, sometimes we can't. So, you know, it's the individual that won't get paid, not you. So if you could please abide by the deadlines. The ones for July, starting in July, we're working on them now, and they should be up on our website by the beginning of next week, and an email will go out to all the POPS users. And also, to make sure that you do get all of your emails for POPS, you have to make sure that you are registered for the listserv. So make sure you are on the listserv, because that's the only way we send out information concerning POPS, is on the listserv, okay? Audit requirements. So I spoke to internal audit yesterday, and they said supporting documents are required for every type of payment that you process. You need a copy of the offer letter outlining the terms of the contract. So the offer letter, or if you have a flyer for like a speaker that's coming in, or you have a specific form, you can use that. You should be using timesheets for everybody. They need to be authorized before transmission by the supervisor and the employee and the fund, and emails are not acceptable. You cannot accept an email from a professor saying, please pay John Brown $3,000. Internal audit will not accept it. They want specific instructions on what the individual is doing and why you're paying the individual, okay? And I would also think that the auditors that come in to audit your funds would be asking exactly what the individual, not just $3,000 for some professor on his grant from the PI. So, you know, also for reminders, they said all overtime must be pre-approved. So you have to make sure that any overtime that is being worked by individuals in your area is pre-approved by the supervisor first. And POPS requisitions should not be transmitted before the work is performed. So you shouldn't be sending something in if the work has not been performed by the individual yet. Also, I just wanted to mention that for POPS, we are migrating POPS to a central server, and that should be done by the end of August. At that point in time, we will probably be able to make minor modifications to the software itself. Basically, we can't do it right now because it's on everybody's computer themselves. You have your own copy. We are migrating it centrally so we can try and make modifications because of all the changes that have come up because of the collective agreement. So in the future, we're going to try and make some minor, and at that point in time, when we do make the modifications, we will be sending out a communique to say this is the type of form you have to use and these are the requirements that you have to use now to be using these payments for individuals. Okay.
No questions? No?
If a professor is away and he agrees to pay a student, although we have a letter, he attaches us a letter that he wants to pay $3,000 over the summer for a student who's working, is that allowed? Like, by him sending us an email saying, I do approve of this, I'll sign when I'm back, I'm just away, but start paying him?
If you get an email from him to say that he's going to sign, but you should also... If you're doing stuff and he's away, he should be delegating signing authority to somebody else. You should have some kind of letter saying that.
Well, that was the issue. That was the issue at the delegation signing authority, that the POPS payment, there is no signing, that, like, it's online now.
Yeah, I know, so, but he should be giving you. You should be having some type of form letter in your department.
So we'll still use a form
letter.
That
professor does give signing authority delegation for this period of time for this fund.
But his email should be also attached because he's
yes,
the one.
Yes, should be attached. But if he hasn't signed before, then make sure that he does sign when he gets back.
Okay.
But you can also, I mean, depending on where he is, you can also scan him a copy. You can sign it, and he can scan it back for you, right?
I'm just saying that I want to make sure that it is allowable since
yes,
we don't want.
Yes, you can have it scanned and have it signed and have it sent back to you like okay. that too. Yeah. That's just to keep it for audit purposes. So when they go out, because there's a lot of people going out and auditing everybody now. So. Opal changes. Okay. The rule of thumb is if you've processed a Minerva appointment form and you want to make a change or a correction to a FOPL, then you have to make a Minerva FOPL maintenance form. Okay, so you're paying somebody on an appointment form through Minerva. If you want to change or correct a FOPL, it should be going back through Minerva to make the change. Okay, the only time you should use the HR payroll FOPL journal request form is if you get an error. So let's say you tried to go in, we were running the pay, it said something, or you went in and it said there's all sorts of errors that they can't find the pay event or it can't find something. At that point in time, if you could just print the error, and then you'll have to use the paper form that we have, and if you could just attach the error to the back of the paper form, staple it, because when we get the errors, we go in and we try and modify the system to correct the error so they will not happen in the future. So that is the only time that the FOPL journal request form should be used for a Minerva appointment form. And the other time it should be used is for POPS payments, okay? Because POPS are not done through Minerva, you have to do those manually. We are in the process of redesigning the form. So hopefully, I'd say by the end of the summer, but I'm going to say by the end of the year. Yeah, because you say summer and then it becomes the end of the year because it's already June. That hopefully by the end of the year that we will have a new form up on our HR website, because we are redesigning it with RFMS right now. I'm looking at the form. So for the POPS payments, the backup that we do, we also do require backup, so we know what you're trying to journalize. So you can either attach a copy of the POPS requisition, or you can print out your CRISA report, and then you can just highlight the ones that you want done and stuff like that. Okay. So from the collector table, we have a pay event down here, okay? You know what's on the POPS requisition, so you'd be able to see that if this was for John Black, it would be from May 1st to May 7th. If that's the one that you want journalized, you can just print this out and attach it to the journal form, staple it. It first has to go to RFMS. Or Office of the Budget, depending on who the fund administrator is. It has to go over there for approval first. Once they see that there are enough funds for the journal to be done, then they will forward it over to HR. Please do not forward anything to HRHR for a journal, or POPS.HR to be a journal. If you could please send it to your finance administrator first in financial services, and then they will forward it to us in HR so that we can process the journal. Okay. This is the form presently on the system. The from and to dates seem to be the biggest difficulty for individuals. Those dates, if you look at our payroll schedules that we send you, we have dates on the left-hand side, and then the pay event is on the right-hand side of the payroll schedule when you look at it. If you want to journalize those dates, then you just make sure you put those dates on it, and we will journalize the pay event, let's say 14, so that when you look at your crystal report, it will all match. But those dates are on our schedule. So for semi-monthly, it says the 1st to the, let's say, 15th of June. That will be pay event 11. So, but you have to remember that if you want $700 journalized and someone has benefits, it goes $700 and it brings the benefits with it, which might make it $800. So if you only want $700 done, you have to make sure that the salary portion is smaller then, because we are going to take the associated benefits that go with that salary portion, and we are going to also do a journal on that. Okay? The stuff down on the bottom is all going to be changed right now, because it used to be sent to Elaine, as you can see, in payroll. It's a really old form. So it will be changed at some point in time this year. So we will be sending that out to everybody at that point in time.
Just to clarify here, because in the past, where Minerva forms work fine if it's still an active appointment, but if the appointment has ended, you have no choice but to use the journal.
No, you can do retro FOPO maintenance on terminated appointments now.
Now?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's been for actually quite a while. If you go into Minerva under the appointment form process and you pick FOPL, I think it's FOPL change or FOPL maintenance, there is a icon in the upper right-hand corner that says help. Mm-hmm. And in there is all the documentation of exactly how you can do the changes. And it says specifically in there that you can do it on terminated appointments now.
Good. Okay. The second thing is that when we've had to use journals in the past, the other time was when a portion of the salary had been done manually.
If you have sent the Minerva form in late and payroll had to make a manual payment, that's when it says the pay event cannot be found. Because we only use the original pay events that we run with the regular pays, and the manual ones, we have not fixed the system yet to be able to accept those, and that's when it comes up with that message. But if you, like I said, you can use that form if you do get an error, but you have to make sure that there is backup staple to say there was an error. If you send it in and we don't have the error, we're going to have to call you back and say, why did you send it? Because sometimes, and it might only do one pay event that there's a problem with. Let's say the first one you sent the Minerva appointment form came in late. You might only have a problem with the one pay event, but the other four going forward.
Yeah, that's the way we've done it in the past.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem.
On the form, what you showed before, which I know
one?
You mentioned the previous page. So you mentioned at the bottom that the approvals, it's in the works. It's going to get changed, right?
Yeah.
So right now it goes up to the dean. My recommendation, well, I'm sure you're doing it, but I'm just saying, shouldn't it be the financial fund manager to be signing?
The change that's going to be made is the number, there's numbers, we're going to put 1, 2, and 3. The first one says fund manager. The second one is going to say fund administrator, and the third one is going to be HR shared services.
Okay.
So it's going to start with fund, and then it'll go over to financial services, and then it will come to us, and then we will be approving it at that point in time. Yeah. So a lot of people call us and ask specific questions, and they're looking for like the POPS documentation. And there is POPS documentation. There is a lot of POPS documentation on our HR website. So if you basically go to our HR website and you log in on a front page under HR administrators, and it's HR POPS procedures, you'll find all our guides, the timesheets, the mapping of the account codes for the requisitions that you're picking. That's all there. In the same area, you'll also see the HR payroll FOPL journal request form. So on the side, it has forms. You'll be able to go in there and print that form out from there. And if you are having any inquiries must be done through our service center, okay? That's our first stop. You have to go there, you have to either write them an email, or you have to phone them at 4747, okay? And if they have inquiries, they will come over to the other areas and ask for explanation, and then they will respond after that. But basically, you have to go through our HR service center if you do have queries about payroll and or benefits or pension or any HR subject, okay? People, some of the other questions we get asked all the time is, like, which POPs requisition should we use? To be honest, we don't know. Because the individual does not work for us. The individual works for you. So you have to try and gauge what they're doing comparative to, let's say, a full-time individual that is on campus. Like, if you hired a student for the summer, is he doing, like, clerical-type work, or is he doing, like, technical-type work, or is he doing course or research-related work? So you have to think about what the individual is doing, and that's how you decide which form to use. Because we get a lot of calls saying, well, I don't know which requisition to use. But we can't really help you at that point in time, because we do not know what the individual is doing. We try to guide you in the right direction, but we cannot tell you exactly which forms to use, okay? The other...
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Sorry, one of the issues that I have that comes back to that what you just mentioned is undergraduate students who are neither course... nor research assistants, nor doing course-related work, but they're doing academic work. I'm thinking a lot of work-study students in our department.
What do you mean by academic work?
They're working for academics using academic, say scientific illustrators where their work is related to the prof's research. Their work is technical. It is also part of the research, but they're not research assistants, and they're not course assistants. But their work is academic.
Okay, so related. On the POPs requisition, there's two selections, right?
Yeah, for undergraduates, I'm thinking specifically. Because for graduates, it's not a problem, but undergraduates?
Yeah, it says undergraduate student course assistant. Like, POPs is an old piece of software, and we are going to, like, make minor modifications. And some of the modifications we're going to make are to the titles.
Okay.
So I imagine what we should have done is undergraduate student assistant. We should have said the same thing. So if it's doing that the same type of work as a graduate student assistant, then I would be using the undergraduate student course assistant.
Okay.
For if you're looking for
you.
An area to put in. It's just to make sure that if they are research assistants, to make sure in the drop-down menu that you pick that specific one, because they are unionized and they have to have union dues taken off.
Okay.
And that's the only way that we can do it, along with the code of RAU 13. Okay, so I know I'm stressing it again, but it really needs to be put on. The same thing with invigilators. You need to type in invigilators, because presently that's the only way we can identify them on the system to be able to take union dues off of them, okay?
Thank you.
When would you use a casual payment academic staff versus a T4 payment academic staff?
T4A?
T4A, if I see the correctly. You have casual payment academic staff. And you have T4A payment academic staff. What's
T4A
the difference?
Payments on campus are only paid to doctors and dentists. They're like self-employed individuals, so we can do that. T4A payments are also used if you are a guest lecturer coming in, let's say from another university in Canada, then you can put those through as a T4A. If you're having a non-resident guest lecturer come in, you use the non-resident T4A payment type, okay? Which is here. Underneath is a link.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a link there to our HR website. And on our HR website, there's a whole documentation of exactly what you have to do for a non-resident, all the forms you have to fill in for the government, and all the backup that we do need to pay a non-resident. And for payments for non-residents, it takes quite a long time for the government to respond to us. So the quicker you send it in, the quicker we will be able to pay the individual. If the individual comes in May and you send it in May, it's possible that he will only get paid in August. Because by the time we get all the documentation and we fax it to the federal government and the provincial government to come back and give us a response, it takes sometimes 2 to 3 months.
So the government has to approve every single non-resident T4 payment?
If the individual does not want to be taxed. If the individual wants to be taxed, you can tell us he can be taxed. But most people that come in do not want to be taxed. So they have to fill out a waiver form, and we send it off to the government, and we wait for the responses.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when would you use a casual payment academic staff?
If the individual's, let's say, a research assistant, but not a student at McGill University. If the individual is a course lecturer, and it's not paid through the Minerva course lecturer form, then it can be paid as a casual payment. The student form should only be used if they are students at McGill University. If you're doing other type of academic work, like research associate or something like that, which should be paid through an appointment form, really, but if they're doing like that, or visiting scientists or something like that that comes in and they're coming in for one time, then it should use casual payment for academic staff. Because you have to gauge the payment type to what we're paying full-time at McGill University. So all the academics have titles, right? So if you have a casual coming in doing the same type of work as one of your professors, then you would be using that. If you're having someone come in and doing clerical work or management work, then you have to gauge it on that. That's why we like the proper titles in there. Professional associate, you know, professional assistant. So we'll know what the individual is doing. And at that point in time, you know what type of form to use and you know what type of account code to use. Because all the definitions are on the financial services knowledge base.
Okay.
Yeah. And just a reminder about the dates on the journal form. If you don't know the dates, you can leave them blank, okay? If it's easier for you just to put the pay event in from biweekly 12 to biweekly 14, then that's fine too. We don't have any problem. It's just to make sure that the percentages all add up to 100, okay? So, like, you know, if you're adding up and you got $100 on the top and you got $90 on the bottom, it doesn't work. I know that sometimes you only want to do one FOPL and keep it on the other FOPL that's on the top, then you have to put that other FOPL on the bottom too, so it totally adds up to 100% because we do have that difficulty. If you send stuff in and it doesn't balance, then we just wait for you to come back and tell us exactly, you know, what you really want. And a reminder that when year end comes, please don't send everything at the last minute because we cannot get things through for you. And the difference between what payroll does and what financial services, the financial services can go back at the beginning of the month and put it back in the previous month. Once payroll is closed, we cannot go back to a previous month and make any corrections. It stays in the month that we do process the journal in or any type of payment in. We can't go back and forth in years or anything. Okay. That's the end of my presentation. Are there any more questions?
Chance.
You don't have any other HR payroll related questions?
But it's not related to the forms.
No, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be to the slides either. If you have any other payroll questions, I have no problem trying to answer them.
Because I ran into one of my grants. When does the commitment, if the salary is encumbered, and the salary is paid out, when does the commitment come off? When does the encumbrance come off of the fund? Because it doesn't seem to disappear.
It will disappear once the month and the payment is done. But you have to realize, too, that if the form says up to the end of, let's say, the 28th of June, that payment for payroll might only get paid in July, right? So it will stay encumbered in July and will only disappear when you look at something in August then.
But the payroll for the 15th of June will only be released again in August? Because that's what seems to be happening. If the payment is due on the 15th?
Once the payment goes through, it will come out of the income. It will only leave the one for the end of the month.
At the end of the month? Well, no, I've seen it where it didn't. That's why I'm asking.
But that depends on when the push goes from HR into financial services, right? So we run our pays. And then there's a push that goes from HR into financial services. So depending on when that push is dependent on when the encumbrance will get changed. Because once something's been charged, then it should be deducting it from the encumbrance.
But that's not always the case. That this is it. You don't really have a date.
There is a timing thing. There is a timing issue between when we do our stuff in HR and when it gets fed to financial services. There is a timing. Because I think the feed, if I'm not mistaken, somebody correct me, the feed is every Wednesday night that gets fed in. So if we happen to run the pay on a Thursday, then only the next Wednesday, week. And when it shows up, if you look in NHI DIST, you can see that it's been changed. But sometimes if you go through your CRISA reports, it doesn't show up till Friday. Because we've had people call us and say, well, it's not there on Thursday, and we're like, well, we can see it in NHI DIS, so wait till tomorrow. So I'm not sure what happens with the data warehouse. But yeah, there is a timing issue, and it all has to do with when we feed to financial services or when the feed to financial services is done. If you get really lucky and we run a pay on Tuesday, it should be in the Wednesday. It should be there by the end of the week, but that's really dependent on when everything is processed.
I actually have two questions. I have to give an award to a person, and that person is no longer a registered student. So I cannot do it in BSAC, and I have to do it through POPS, right?
Were they a McGill University student?
They were, yeah.
Then you need to contact the people at BSAC. They are supposed to be making arrangements to pay students.
But she has graduated. So
my understanding is if you contact them, they will make arrangements.
I did. They told me it needed.
Owed. Sorry?
Okay. I did contact them. They told me it needed to be a POPS payment.
I'm like, okay, so they might be telling you that, but they told us in financial services and in HR that it will be going through them.
If the person is not currently a registered student.
Yeah.
Because
the
it's...
They were registered. Yeah. Put the person in the last term they were registered.
Yes.
Through them, through.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. My next question is to do with the form here. When you said earlier that the signature will change... And there will be the FFM, that HR payroll journal form. You said that the new version will have...
It'll say fund manager.
Fund manager, financial administrator.
And then it will say financial administrator, which I guess is RFMS, right? And then HR, so I keep wanting to say research and restricted funds, just so that's why, okay?
That,
I want to say RRF.
Fine.
And then the last one will be us. It will say payroll, it'll say HR shared services here.
So would we consider adding the FSD? As a signature in the form?
No. The people in financial services are going, no.
And why not?
Somebody give somebody a mic in financial services. Her question is, why not?
Researcher will come to us and
usually the researcher comes to us and says, there's an overpayment, what do I do? We suggest that we transfer a payment because it's all payroll, I would say. We're in it, but there's no stamping. It goes to our FMS anyways.
And I agree. I just want to see if, as a way of making sure that it does come to us, in the event that maybe potentially somebody would submit something without coming through us, if we
want to. Four hands? How many hands?
I think essentially the FFM, which is usually the PI, needs to sign these forms. It's been established by internal audit. It's been established by our external auditors repeatedly over the last few years. So we do want the FFM in the loop. Mm-hmm. We're there centrally to approve these, so we know the eligibility and compliance regulations with all our grants. And to make it go yet through another set of hands, I'm not sure that that's the most efficient use of our time. So, I mean, we can review these after the fact. The FSDs have reports for that. And right now, I'm not sure we're ready to put FSDs on these documents.
What are the auditing requirements for retention of supporting documents? How many years do we have to keep them?
It's 7 years. So you keep them in your office for a specific amount of time, or you electronically scan them to make sure that they are. But on the HR procedures document, there is a link to archives to say what documents have to be kept for what amount of time. If you're looking for the payroll documents, you have to go under financial documents, not HR, okay? And it tells you in there exactly how long that you have to keep these documents for. I looked that up last night. There you go. I'm like, I better look that up, see if it's there for them.
I would just like to clarify that it is 7 years, and it is 7 years for tri-agency grants as well. But if the payroll is being charged to another type of restricted fund, those restricted funds might have a longer requirement. So there are some federal agencies that we deal with that it's actually 10 years. Sometimes it's 12. So you do have to look at where the fund is and look if there's a specific reporting retention period that's longer. I would say standard is 7, and if it's not listed in that agency's agreement or terms or whatever, then go by institutional policy.
Yeah, because we don't know the rules for the agency agreement. So for the payroll, it's 7 years, but like she said, if the agency has specific rules, then you need to abide by what the agency agreement says.
Hi, Debbie.
Hello.
Retro FOPO.
Mm-hmm.
So one day I had to make a correction on one of the funds wrongly charged. So fund administrator say, I'll send you a payroll FOPO journal request form. So I completed, I sent it in. Then I got another email by another fund administrator saying, no, you should do retro FOPO yourself. So what is right, what is wrong?
You can't do it.
If it was a Minerva appointment form, the rule of thumb is you need to do the FOPO maintenance through Minerva. It's a very easy rule. If it's a Minerva form, it has to be a Minerva FOPO maintenance.
Right.
If it's a POPS payment, it has to be done through the HR FOPO form. Okay. If you get an error when you're in Minerva, then you can use the paper form for Minerva stuff. Otherwise, Minerva forms need to be journalized through the Minerva form.
So
it's much more efficient that way. It goes through automatically, research, whatever, RRF. They approve it, and it automatically gets pushed in. We don't have to touch those forms at that point in time. All the paper forms that are sent in have to be manually processed.
Yes.
The other part has been automated by us.
Yes.
So it's a much quicker process.
Okay.
So like I said, Minerva form, Minerva FOPO maintenance change. POPS form, the paper form.
But if that's an error,
unless it has an error, and that's what I had said in the slide at the beginning.
Right.
Yeah.
So the first one was correct. Thank you.
B. RFMS.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's here.
I just wanna ask.
That's really big for me.
We seem to have a lot of surrounding issues regarding, is it the electronic form? Is it the paper form? Is it used for this error? Is it used for that error? Will there be a time where there's only one method of processing these retro FOPO adjustments for any type of payroll type adjustment so that it funnels through one area electronically and it's hopefully automatically updated just like the Minerva?
No, we would
because
like
I think that would be the best.
Yeah, we would like to automate it, but yeah. POPS is a piece of software outside of Banner,
understand.
Right? So unless we get a piece of software that's integrated into Banner and it can look at the records, the payroll records that are on there, yeah, it won't be right now.
Okay.
Because this is not Banner. If we were in the time entry system with Banner, then it would be automated at that point in time. And the only problems that would arise is if there was like a form that came in late and we can't identify what the individual is trying to change.
Okay.
But presently, as long as we have POPS, I don't think they're going to automate it right now.
Okay.
Until we get a new one-time payment system, which is on the horizon.
I know.
Maybe.
Okay.
Possibly.
Thank you.
I just want to know, was I just daydreaming or did I hear you say that the manual, for the pays that are processed on Minerva, but the ones that are done manually, that at some point in the future you'll be able to capture them?
We're going to try
them
and automate that, yes. That's the reason why we want the error sent in.
Yeah.
So we can try and have that corrected. But it's
fabulous.
Because it has identified it. It looks for the original pay. Like, say,
today's
semi-monthly payday. So for all the original pays, it has no problem. It can go forward and look at them. It can go back and look at them also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when we have an off run, like a manual one, it can't identify what got paid, right? So it has difficulty with that.
Okay.
And we have not found out how to fix it yet. Mm-hmm. But it's there.
Coming.
with the other 100 things that are there, right, that we would like to automate. Excuse me. She's had her hand up for a little while.
Debbie, you said that POPS requisitions should not be submitted unless the dates have been worked by the person.
I mean, on our schedules, it tells you that this payday, that these are the dates related to that payday. This is the payday, this is the pay event, this is the dates related to that event. One of the other questions that was asked was when the person looks at their stub for a casual, the date, the from and to dates on it don't match what they're getting paid from POPS. And we know that. And the reason for that is because they're paid on the same payroll as the students are paid, the Minerva appointment forms are paid, and the date on the top of that match the Minerva appointment form. Banner can't have two different dates to say that the biweekly pay is this for this and this for this. So it picks one date, and it picks the one that belongs to the Minerva appointment forms. But you can see what they got paid for by going to the collector table and seeing what the proper dates are for that individual.
But what do you do when a department submits a requisition and says these are the dates worked and it happens to coincide with the same date that they want, the same week that that they're asking that the student or whoever it is or the whoever the person is be paid?
They shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, but I got a call. I got a call from payroll though, telling me that I had to submit a requisition in as soon as possible because the date said that they should be paid on a certain date. But they had even they would have worked till that final day. They would have worked, let's say, till the 15th of May, and the pay date was the 15th of May as well. So, what do you do in that case?
I'm going to take next week because it'll be easier for me, right? So the casuals will be paid on the 20th of June.
Okay.
Next week, right? They should only be paid up to and covering up to the 7th of June. Okay?
Because well, that's what I'm saying.
They work up to the 7th, and transmit the week in between, and then we pay.
So
they
what do we
be
do?
Paying, they shouldn't be paying them up to the 14th. Because by the time they transmit it on the Wednesday, which is the 12th, they haven't worked the other 2 days. If the person falls in sick or anything...
But why did I get a call from payroll telling me to submit that requisition in?
Well, you can come see me after and give me the money. Don't talk to that person. Because they shouldn't be telling you that.
Okay.
Yeah. No. We shouldn't be putting dates in for work that has not been performed. Okay?
Thank you.
Also a reminder, for the salaried casuals on the Minerva appointment forms, if the individual doesn't work a day, you have to remember to put an undertime through POPS. Okay? Because they automatically get paid, the salaried casuals, for everything. So if they won't be working the summer Fridays, you have to remember to go in and put a form in under the non-academic casual requisition, not the undertime requisition on overtime, right? The non-academic casual requisition, and you have to go in and put the negative hours that the individual is not to be paid for, okay? For the other casuals that are covered by the AMUSE collective agreement, do not pay them for statutory holidays. They get it on every paycheck now, okay? So they already get paid for their holidays by what's in the collective agreement. So you should go to our website, print out the collective agreements, and read them because it tells you what the casuals will get paid for AMUSE and what AMUR has now negotiated to be paying for their casuals also, okay?
I have two questions. I am FS team. So for mining materials, and I would like to know, can we have access to, I do have access to see the pay days, the list of the pay days, you know, pay number 12 covered this, that, can I go to the HR website and find out that schedule for payments?
Those are on our HR website.
Yes, do we have access?
Everybody has access to their employee services. If you go and getting paid, it says schedules. All the schedules are there. The biweekly one is there, the biweekly one for POPS, and the semi-monthly one.
Next week we will
be sending out the next 6 months. Mm-hmm. We will also be sending out a separate one just for the summer dates so that everybody knows what the dates are for the summer
for
time
the
because of the summer Fridays and that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we will be sending that out next week.
Yeah, for Minerva appointments as well. Is there in the HR website?
Sorry?
For Minerva appointments.
No, I don't know. Payroll. We do POPS.
Oh, okay.
the dates that we have for payroll, the Minerva appointment forms are the same type of mm-hmm. dates. Okay, because it all gets pulled into the pay that we are going to run.
Okay.
There are no dates for Minerva. When you put it in, if it gets pushed in time, it will go into the pay. If it doesn't get pushed in time, it won't go into the pay.
Okay. The second question is, you have improved a lot the timing of processing this HR payroll for all journal entries.
Yeah, thank because they're you. Automated. Yeah. They're automated now.
Now it's automated. So what is the time frame for that right now? Is I submitted the June 15th, when the correction is going to be shown in the system?
We don't know. Because it has to go to your financial administrator first?
No, but I know that it's going to you in June 15th because I asked them to CC me when it's going to you.
Are you talking about a Minerva one or a paper one?
No, this one. The HR payroll football.
Okay, so if they send it over to us on mm-hmm. June 15th, it should be processed within that month.
Within a month.
Okay. Yeah, it should be processed within that month. Unless there is, like, if we got it around June, let's say we got it on Monday on the 17th, it should be processed in the month of June.
Okay, that is
okay.
Okay.
The word is should.
Okay. It should. That is why I request to be CC.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
They don't always get done in time, so, but... Depends on the volume that we have. Yeah.
When I look in the ledger, I can see the individual that's being paid, and I chose the 4% for vacation. Mm-hmm. Where do I see the 3.2 for stats holiday?
You'll see it. It should be right below it. It should be right below it, yeah.
Okay, because I've looked and I haven't seen it. I mean, I go every so often to see when there's
depends,
a holiday.
That depends on whether or not they're covered by the AMUSE collective agreement, because not all non-academic casuals that are clerical and technical are covered by the AMUSE collective agreement. There are exceptions.
Okay.
So maybe you only have the 4% because you put it on there and your area is not covered by the collective agreement. There are exceptions to the collective agreement. There's only about maybe 5-10 departments that aren't covered for their casuals by the AMUSE collective agreement. They've been exempted.
Okay.
But otherwise, you should see the charge for like the $100 and then the 4% and then the...
And then the 3.2%.
Yeah.
Okay.
3.2 for AMUR.
Yeah, for AMUR. I'm talking
about
AMUR.
You're talking
about...
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But they only got unionized in April.
In April, yeah,
so
that's it.
So anything going April forward, you should see an extra charge on your funds.
I should see an extra charge.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Hi. In the new collective agreement for research associates and research assistants, I believe that the sick days are not paid. So if an employee gets sick, is there a way to deduct the pay, or is there some other arrangement that needs to be made?
Are these full-time research assistants and research associates?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. Did you go to the presentation that was given by Denis Gauthier in
yes,
our department?
But he wasn't able to answer that question.
He was not able to answer that question.
No. he said that you have to make up the time. He couldn't vouch for what payroll would do to deduct the pay. If we could deduct
well,
the pay,
if
the person falls sick, let's say the person takes a sick day.
Okay, so if it's only one, they don't get any sick days in our collective agreement?
No.
Okay, so if it's only one day, you can write to us in payroll and ask us to deduct a day's time from his paycheck. And I don't have the names up. So I will give the names to Brenda, and she can send out to everybody the names of the payroll specialists to send the email to if you do have to take undertime for a full-time research assistant or research associate. Yeah. There are two specific payroll specialists.
Sorry. Hello? Yeah. I did the presentations with Denis Gauthier.
Samantha,
yeah.
Here you go.
And the first step is to assess with the research supervisor what kind of arrangements had been made initially with those research associates or research assistants on the regular appointments. Normally, there is accommodation made that they'll make up the hours at another time or arrangements like that prior to going and asking to dock pay. Make sure you have a conversation with the individual and the supervisor first.
Thank you, Samantha. That's it. Thank you all.
Thank you very much, Debbie. For our next presenter, I'd like to invite François Pouliot from Procurement Services.
Good morning, everyone. This isn't intimidating at all. So they say to look for a friendly face. Romina's gone, so I think Elvie will be my friendly face. Thank you. Brenda sent us an invitation at Procurement Services to come and discuss a little bit about what we do here at the university, what is the regulatory framework that every purchase made at the university must, abide by. And we'll give you a little bit of background on that, and then we'll delve right into the specific questions that you have presented. So, does this sound okay? Yes? Now, I was telling the technician, what's her name? Stu? I was telling Stu earlier, I might move around a little bit more than Debbie, so he'll earn his pay this morning. So, really briefly, the agenda that I'd like to follow, and obviously I want this to be as participative a session as possible, so questions don't wait for the end. If you have them, just raise your hand. Motion, hopefully I'll see you. We'll go to a brief introduction, describe who we are, and you see these fancy animations. I thought I would wow you this morning. A little did you know on what is it, what are some statistics, interesting facts about procurement at the university. Public procurement, what's the framework that McGill as a public institution, even though we have private funds coming in into endowment, into consideration, what are the rules that still apply? A strategic plan for our unit, I won't go too deeply into that, but just so you know where we're going, where we want to go, and that so that we can be aligned. the procurement framework at the university, so specific to our processes, our tools, and the limited resources that we have. In your day-to-day, what does that mean? That will be the section where we dive right into your questions. And I'll do a little bit of advertising for our upcoming value services platform as well. And then if questions haven't been asked, then we'll keep some time at towards the end. So how's that for an animation? So, yes. So who am I? Well, that sounds like a line from a movie. Who am I? François Pouliot, Director of Procurement Services Unit at McGill University. I joined McGill in June of 2011. I made most of my career in procurement, in industry, some bit in pharmaceuticals, and then did some consulting before I came to McGill. I was actually headed right farther north, but then I got invited into several interviews, and the last one was happened at the convocations, I think the second to last day of convocations of 2011. And of course, I have three kids, so you can think about the future, and you're like, well, I could be part of this. Yeah, what about if I bring my experience here and try and help this happen as opposed to putting some more money into a CEO's pockets? So I had this bit. I grew up surrounded by teachers, basically two of them, the university teachers, one in agriculture, one in math. My father is a math professor. My mother is a coordinator, was an administrative coordinator. My wife is a school teacher. My in-laws are both teachers in the chemistry and the nursing. So basically, I guess there was a pattern here that, a career procurement professional. And, I left that line in. Actually, I thought I had taken it out, but at least I don't have the picture of me in blue tights and a red cape. So. So the evolution of procurement services, because there were things going on before I arrived, definitely. It used to be called just the purchasing office. Where it was located on campus, I could not tell you. I think they were pretty much distributed in several areas. And then it became procurement services under the ancillary services of university services. I guess 2010, procurement services was repatriated under financial services. At that time, Albert Caponi recruited Eric Legros, a former colleague of mine from industry. And it's actually through Eric that I found out about him leaving and the job opening at McGill. And maybe in the future, maybe it will, if we manage our integration successfully, we'll call it procurement and financial services. And you'll note I listed procurement first. So who we are? Procurement services, right, we said that. We're located at 3465 Durocher, so that's east of campus for those of you who don't have the walking shoes and spend their days walking around. First floor, and yes, we are on both sides of the hall. So we are a service unit, so even though we do controls and compliance and monitoring and system fixing, we're primarily a service unit. So we're there to try and help the best way we can with the resources we have and get innovative, creative when the tools don't fit. Did I see a raised hand in the back? No? Okay, sorry. The mission that had been adapted for this unit, I think it was Eric or maybe Alan and Kathy Zindabad that brought it before I arrived, was attain procurement excellence through customer-focused services and value-added strategies while optimizing resources in support of the university's mission. So it's big, it's ambitious, I like it. So who we are? Well, probably best known of all of our features and staff is the procurement help desk. So even though it looks like we have an army, it's really only Crystal manning the help desk and doing her best to answer all the inquiries. But that wouldn't be fair to Suzanne, who's in the background, is our system administrator for McGill Marketplace, a new tool that is called 4D Proc, which helps draft systems and, contracts, call for tenders, and various clauses. We have a vendor records administrator, so most of you will have heard of Sila Correa and her team as well. They manage vendor records activation, vendor records. The activation, we're up to 11,000 vendors in our active database right now. So that's both great and a problem at the same time. We have a certified project manager because it gets more and more difficult at the university to get resources, specifically with project management at facilities and project management at IT, to have the research and, I guess, all of the administrative units projects carried forward when it involves having a project manager come on board. So our sorts of patches that gap, if you will, if you have a purchasing, a sourcing project, and it will end up needing a IT project manager, for example, but because you don't have your business case approved and it hasn't gone through the IT steering committee, we rely on the resources inside the procurement services to try and bridge that gap a little bit. We have a strategic sourcing analyst, an accountant, which keeps reminding me that, yes, we are a services unit, but we do need to do the controls and compliance thing. We have a four buyers core team. I call them the core team because basically they service no customer in particular. It's really the because of the files that they are handling, they handle, they deal with basically all of the campus. And we have four satellite buyers. Two of them actually have room currently at other units. So we have two at facilities. One is moving to medicine imminently. And we have another one who will be going to IT. We're discussing with residences and food services to have one there as well. If at the Faculty of Medicine the experience proves positive as part of the Administrative Excellence Center, then definitely we will want to repeat that with other faculties. We have a part-time sustainable procurement officer. We thought that the best place to influence the life cycle of the goods that we and equipment that the university is purchasing was at the very beginning. And so we are working with the Sustainability Office of University Services in putting in place the best possible strategies to positively influence the rest of the life cycle. And we have a travel management program manager. Maybe some of you have been in focus groups or in presentations held by Ms. Gloria Bashar. Gloria is a term employee. She's here to try and deliver the best travel management program possible. So she's doing heavy consultation on that. And as of May of last year, we actually have a dedicated legal counsel. So of all the features, I think for those that have had to deal with contracts and big time purchases, this is probably the single biggest difference before the addition of the legal counsel is his ability to come in and settle a difference with a contract with a supplier to get the best possible contract in place. Associate director Kathy Zindabad, I think most of you will know her. She's been working at McGill for a long time. Very important source of knowledge and a good coach for me. And myself, director, and newly appointed CRCM. What's that CRCM? The animation again, I'm blown away. CRCM, well, that's a function actually that was created by law, so it wasn't a big promotion or anything, it's just an added function. Really, things that we were already doing. It's a contract rules compliance monitor, and what it does is, well, this function is appointed by the Board of Governors, and the individual that, sorry about hitting the mic there, the individual that receives this appointment has to monitor the purchasing contract process so that it's all done in line with the requirements from the law. So I guess we'll have the presentation circulated, Brenda, I believe. I won't go into detail, but it's basically, again, about compliance and making the necessary recommendations to the chief executive officer of the university, to which in the case of the university is not the principal. It's interesting. It's the board, so making reports and recommendations to make acquisitions of systems, to change certain aspects of our process, to add the resources or to obtain the permission to move them from one location to another. Did you know, purchasing at McGill, 58,000 purchase order per year. They are each of them a legally binding agreement, which is why it's so important to have the McGill standard terms and conditions used so that we don't dive into the unknown 58,000 times a year. The orders that are placed for $100,000 and more are for the most part placed under the authority of approximately 300 live contracts that we have currently signed with suppliers. Those purchase orders, they mean 113,000 invoices per year. That's for $185 million in calendar year 2012 in MMP. Well, that one went faster somehow. Yeah, 285 plus millions in purchase orders total. That includes banner purchase orders at facilities, construction, renovation contracts for the most part, which are not currently processed through the McGill marketplace. You have to add to that $17 million in the last year on the purchase card. And with the payment request, there's actually a total of approximately $400 million per year in external transactions. So what we try to do at the procurement services to facilitate this volume is that we do keep that core of 300-plus contracts alive by signing 80 to 90 new contracts per year. If you do the maths, actually, it adds up. The law imposes that contracts, except under special circumstances, not be extended beyond a three-year term. So we're close to adding 100 per year. So through a cycle, and with the exceptions of those contracts that do last a little bit longer, that's the number of contracts that we need to sign every year to sustain that number of contracts. Our office, through these 80 or 90 year, new contracts per year, channels approximately $50 million in contracts every year. It takes 88 days on average to execute a contract. So that's not the stat that I am most proud of. It's important to note that when we use standard terms and conditions that we post with the call for tender and which become mandatory for bidders to abide by, to accept when they submit in their bid, we truncate, we reduce that lead time by a full 46 days. So we have experimented with that in the last few months of fiscal year 13, and this is definitely a trend that we want to expand, because then it would reduce our contracting time to approximately a month and a half, which is where we want to go. Yes, sorry. For the mic.
Wouldn't that the call for bid, that would apply to anything that's over 100,000, right?
Correct. You could also apply it to a contract that's less, but you want to maximize competition, or you're not sure that the value will not jump after the contract has been signed. You don't want to be placed in a situation where you sign an $80,000 contract, but then it has all of this possible expansion to its scope, and end up in a situation where your contract is above $100,000, because then you are not in compliance, and Treasury Board Secretariat are paying attention more and more. We used to report directly to MELS in our procurement matters. I guess when MELS became Mercers, we started reporting to them, but as of January 1st, I don't think there was a session at Parliament then, but in early January, the Act on Probity came out, and as part of the modifications it brought to the law respecting contracting by public bodies, it meant that universities would now report to Treasury Board Secretariat in terms of procurement and compliance to the Act.
Thank you.
Through the exercise of these contracts, I thought I would mention the benchmark that we have looked at for the past two fiscal years is a 3 to 4% procurement savings to budget for those who have processed contracts through the public tender process. In fiscal year 2013, that meant 1.55 million. I don't have a split between how much that means to operational budget versus research. Obviously, research budget, what it does is it doesn't make the purchase, it doesn't save the university money. We fully realize that what this achieves is giving you and all of the researchers more purchasing power with the same sums that they have. Get more get more with what you have. Make more with what you have. So public procurement framework. An act respecting contracting by public bodies that was adopted in October of 2008 applies to all public bodies inside Quebec. Applies to all public contracts passed with any legal person established for a private interest, a general, limited, or undeclared partnership, or a natural person who operates a sole proprietorship. So that leaves out basically only natural persons who don't operate a sole proprietorship enterprise. It would be like calling on an old friend, calling on a retiree and saying, would you do this for me? How much? 2,000? Okay. And he's not a consultant. He's not registered as a company. Those are currently the only ones that where this act doesn't apply. It now applies to organisme à but non lucratif, I guess, so non-for-profit companies, as well as co-ops, cooperatives. We talk about concept of contamination. What is that? Well, it means that even if you have a sourcing project, you're going to purchase big equipment, $1 million, $500,000 of it, $800,000 of it comes from private funding. It comes from a foundation. As long as there is $1 of Quebec funds in that purchase, the act applies. So that's how the contamination may be a bad connotation, but it's used accepted by most procurement personnel. And the act is expanded upon by regulations. The main regulations that apply are the regulation on procurement, which really targets goods, regulation on services contracts of public bodies, and regulation construction contracts by public bodies. So public procurement, again, what does the act aim to achieve? To maintain public confidence in the public procurement process, to enforce transparency in the contracting processes, honest and fair treatment of all tenderers, the opportunity for qualified tenderers to compete. So, you know, I'll take a minute here. Many of you have been exposed to a selection method that we, when we launch a public call for tender, that is called minimum quality, lowest price. It is a misnomer. It is not minimum quality, as in we reduce our minimum quality requirements so that anybody can get on board with the minimum price. It is set what your quality standards are, and those that meet it, among those that meet it, the lowest price supplier will win the bid. The use of effective and efficient contracting procedures, including careful, thorough evaluation of procurement requirements that reflect sustainable development and environmental policies. So what does that mean? Well, with all of the reporting that was just added in April by a modification to the regulation, we're not so sure yet. But we thought we were on our way to have something that was quite lean in terms of bringing a tender to market and contracting with a supplier. The implementation of quality assurance systems for the goods, services, or construction work. It is little used here at McGill, but there are mechanisms in the Act that allow for qualification of certain service suppliers and homologation of goods. So you go through this qualification process, And when you go out for a call for tender afterwards, you are entitled that if your call for tender is primarily for the kind of services for which you have pre-qualified the supplier, then only the suppliers that are pre-qualified will be able to bid. So it is a more controlled manner of who gets in, if you will, who becomes a player in the call for tender. And obviously, Commission Charbonneau, anyone? Accountability by the chief executive officers of public bodies and proper use of public funds. So how does the law do that? Well, we mentioned it earlier. Mandates contracts of $100,000 or more to be publicly tendered and respected. What does that mean? Well, you go into a contract with a supplier for a certain commodity, and it is his expectation, and the law enforces that he should be the only one that you use for the term of his contract for that specific good or commodity that you have contracted him for. There are a few exceptions to both this concept and to actually the overall principle of going out to bid for $100,000 orders or more. Most widely used for the needs of research is Article 28 from the Regulation of Procurement of Goods, which allows that a single supplier may be identified and used for the purpose of, if the purpose of the purchase is research or education. But there are caveats to that, and there's a heavy demonstration to be made. There are four predetermined methods of vendor selection. I mentioned quality, minimum quality, lowest price earlier. There's actually probably the better known one and the most used one is just lowest price. You have a quality adjusted method to make the purchases, which sort of allows you to put a premium on the price if the service or the equipment that this particular supplier proposes as part of his bid outscores the competitions. And the last one, which is can only be used right now for commodities or services that are decided by decree from government, it's quality only. Quality only, why? Well, because the salary, for example, of architects and engineers in construction contracts is predetermined by decree. So there is only competition on quality in that instance. The Act also mandates publication of contract awards of more than $25,000 on government website. So that's where probably now that I think the $100,000 mark is pretty well accepted and that the university community cooperates with procurement services in bringing those to market. But between $25,000 and $100,000, we do have to bring every award, every purchase order that we place for more than this amount, we have to go and store it and publish it on the government's website. So it's easy to see a pattern of orders building up to more than $100,000 with particular suppliers who have not been contracted. And it mandates several involvement by the chief executive officer. For example, when there is only one bidder, the chief executive officer, in our case, through the signing regs, it's been decided that it would be Albert Caponi. So if you're looking for a sort of a chief procurement officer, it will be Mr. Caponi. Looking at it from a perspective of, is there a due process that was followed that resulted in having only one supplier? If that's the case, he would authorize the opening of the financial envelope. We talked about the exceptional case where we would have a contract that's longer than 3 years. So again, we would appeal to the chief executive officer, in our case, the Board of Governors, but through signing regs, it is Albert Caponi that is delegated for these decisions. And the law mandates continuous reporting to Treasury Board Secretariat. So we're still reeling from the last batch of reporting that was announced as part of the April modifications to the regulations. We're putting in place as much as possible automation to save our necks. So strategic plan for procurement services. Big themes, I'm just going to go through them real quick. rebranding of procurement services. So we saw earlier it was called the purchasing office. It would be, at that time, it was really you receive a requisition from a requester inside the university, just flip it into a purchase order, make sure that the terms and conditions are appended to that order, and send it out. We want to modify and increase the footprint of procurement services. We are tasked with that. The evolution of the procurement process, what is that? It's different activities meant to maximize the efficiency, controls, and the returns of McGill's procurement process. Want to monitor effectiveness. The VP that report to in procurement services, Mr. DiGrappa, has established his KPI as being customer satisfaction. So what does that mean for procurement services? Well, I think, and not necessarily in that order, it really means delivering the contracts that you're looking for on time, making sure that the quality you're looking for is there and more, and that you get it at the best deal possible. So those are the KPIs that we are working to. And the overall of supplier relationship management, well, I talked about having 11,000 vendors in our database. So that doesn't lend itself well to doing supplier relationship management unless you have, a very, very high number of brain cells that you can apply to managing all of these at the same time. And how we want to attack this is by apportioning procurement responsibilities between suppliers, users, and procurement services. The way we see it right now is users and procurement services at McGill deal with all the administration, procurement deals with compliance, and the suppliers get paid. So we want to make sure that the process is followed and that it starts with the suppliers. The strategic plan is supported by what? Well, it's integrated into our individual performance dialogue objectives. We do now have a full IT roadmap, but you saw the memo. So we are developing several auto-financing schemes. Does that sound nefarious, schemes? It does? Okay, sorry. Internal audit report. Two months after I joined McGill, we had the visit of our friends at Internal Audit, and we had a very long report and talks that followed. So we are mandated by Internal Audit to bring forward many of these changes. And interestingly enough, even though it does add to the reporting burden for us at Procurement Services, it does mean that we can go to IT, we can go to VP and say that by law we are now mandated to do this or this, and thus we need the tools and we need the resources to do that. So the procurement framework, we talked about the act respecting contracting by public bodies. There are regulations attached to it, more recently policies and directives. Other laws and intergovernmental agreements, so NAFTA comes to mind, some rules between Ontario and Quebec on how service providers can act in Quebec by only being certified, even though they don't typically pay taxes here, that we encounter and that create more difficulty right now are acts that are outdated, most notably the Act on Archiving and the Act, let me see, that's a very, very long title, so pay attention. It's the Act respecting access to documents held by public bodies and the protection of personal information. I'll check on the tape to see if I said that right. But it's pretty much outdated regulations that we're colliding with every time we try and place a contract that deals with these matters. The granting agency's guidelines. So Romina has just left, but we do work in quite frequently with OSR. McGill University procurement policy, hey, 20 years in the making, approved in April. The link, everyone, go and read it. French version available as well. Procurement regulations, procurement plans, procurement procedures, procurement guidelines. Whoa, that sounds heavy. Procurement regulations, One that comes to mind is a travel management program regulation. Once it's out, once we have developed and customized the travel management program that is needed here at the university, it would be embedded into this regulation, and it would be of compulsory character to travel by following the rules set inside those regulations. Procurement plans are more on an incentive-based, character, where you would sign a contract with a certain supplier, which is only a pricing agreement. So you haven't gone through a formal call for tender. That supplier, because he is selling to McGill, decided that he can sell to McGill at 5% less, 10% less, maybe if you squeeze his arm a little bit. So, but you can still continue to purchase from other suppliers. Procurement procedures, well, that's really not going to be standalone documents. We think we're going to put procurement procedures such as how to place an order in MMP right there on the website with all of the clicking functionalities. And procurement guidelines, well, they are to deal with softer matters. Conflict of interest comes to mind. Am I in a conflict of interest if I accept this from the supplier? If I accept to go and visit his site and I don't have the funds to pay for that trip, so he's offering to pay for it. And how far can I go into that trend? McGill signing authority regulations, which we mentioned earlier, they play a role in establishing who is the chief procurement officer at McGill, but as well as to, depending on the value of the contract and what is the type of contract, who is going to be the ultimate signatory. In your day-to-day, what does that mean? Here we are. When to process a payment request versus purchase order on MMP? Good question. The primary procurement channel at McGill University is? Oh, that worked too. McGill Marketplace. However, payment request. I know it spells with only one R, by the way. Just wanted to see if you were paying attention. So the regulation newly adopted, which probably not all of you have seen yet, is adopted on the 26th of March. Here's the link to it. What does that regulation say? Payment request, when do you use it? When no other mean of payment is appropriate. So you can't really use a P-card because maybe the party that you are dealing with is not set up to use credit card. It's not really a purchase that you are making, so a purchase order is kind of odd in that situation. We can think about payments to hospitals, universities, or research agencies for lab fees. I can think of NSERC, renting a plane from NSERC, actually turned out into a purchase order, but that was after a very long story. Institutional advance relating to a joint project or grant. Government offices and life insurance companies relating to withholding taxes, benefits, pension, and insurance premiums. Remittance of society fees to student societies, subject fees and living allowances, and payments made from trust funds. So a payment to a third party on behalf of, I guess, where McGill would be the trustee. We have the funds here, and the party for whom we hold the funds asks us or has committed an expense, needs to transfer funds to a third party, we would use the payment request process as well. So it is a process that is quite heavy on paper compared to the MMP or even the P card. But it is what it is, and it is well supported at accounts payable. In your day-to-day, again, consultant payments, vendors versus payroll, what a question. Understanding employees versus self-employed university policy. Well, at law, how do we differentiate between the two? In legal cases or in reviewing the status of an employee versus a contractor, you will look at the right of control and direction of work. Does the customer have a right of control and direction of the work in his day-to-day task of the individual? If it leans towards, we can tell him exactly what to do, when to do it, We dispatch him to the different locations and so on. The relationship is much more leaning towards the employer situation, as opposed to, well, he has this mandate that we have provided him with. He does it with maybe his own tools, maybe our tools. That would be dependent on the agreement that we have in place. How are we doing on time, Brenda? We're good? Yes. The ownership of the tools and equipment that the individual would be using, chance of profit or loss, integration of the individual into the payer's business. So the university has issued a policy in 2006, which I think was revised in 2008 or 2009. First of all, that university policy does not apply to out-of-Canada situations, probably because of the different regulatory and legal context in other countries. So the policy really relies on what are the general legal principles that we just went through. The individual's status, when it is questioned, has to be determined jointly by HR and financial services. I wish I could do something like you did earlier. Oh, not me, we do POPs. So not us, we do POs. But actually procurement gets to monitor the situation. So what we do is really we look at the spend database, the expenses committed under purchase orders. And when we see a trend that well, the same individual or so many individuals all of a sudden are becoming vendors to the university right after a budget cut that ended in that resulted in the impossibility to hire employees. We bring it up to financial services and the appropriate discussions take place with HR. It is always a question of fact and not a question of intent or a question of I thought that. It is a question of fact when we review the four points above. The four ATLA points above. The terms and conditions of any agreement with that contractor, that contracted individual, would be reviewed. And if in doubt, we err on the side of caution, we treat the contractors as employees. That is also the interpretation ATLA. So we err on the safe side, I guess. Approvals and supporting documents. Requirements on the above. There has been a questionnaire that has been developed to assist in the determination of the employee versus self-employed or independent contractor. That's the link to get to it. Now, in all honesty, for my part, I think that at first that questionnaire helped in making that difference, but very soon people get around to, well, okay, here's what they want to hear. So write that down in the form, and you'll be a contractor. Don't worry, you'll remain a contractor. Don't worry. Integral part of the payment process. So how to make that form, that questionnaire, be mandatory? Well, tie the check to it. So if that form has not been filled and submitted and signed, then the first payment cannot be issued. Now, a little known fact, and probably a little known, followed up on item, is that this form needs to be resubmitted every 12 months to see if the status of that individual has not changed during that period. And if the company that the supplier that we are dealing with actually employs McGill employees and sells their services to the university, then we pick it up a notch. We actually have an official attestation by a signing officer of the supplier. So chief executive officer or chief financial officer primarily is required in that situation. And in that attestation, the exact nature of the services to be performed must be provided along with the incorporation documents. And then it is reviewed to make sure that what he is, that supplier is selling the services of our employee to us for, are not already the tasks and responsibilities that employee has when on the university's payroll. See, I said payroll. PCARD purchases and segregation of duties. You had questions on that. Segregation of duties typically requires the individual creating the request that is going to make use of the purchase should not be the same individual that places the order, which in turn should not be the same individual that reconciles the expense, which in turn should not be the same individual that processes the payment. Picard? Well, Picard bypasses almost all of these criteria. The individual making use of the purchase is most often the same that places the order and reconciles it, and payment is already transacted. So some best practices at the university have been put in place in many areas. A departmental Picard, a sort of a Picard super user. Here, you'll be placing the orders for the six of us kind of thing. And separate Picard administrator from Picard holder. That's actually stipulated in the Picard holder agreement. But again, like the 12-month follow-up on the contractor versus employee thing, rarely followed up on, at 1,800 Picards at the university, so 1,800 Picard holders, you can imagine the massive task that is to do that follow-up. Why some of these best practices have been abandoned through time? Actually, some of them are seen as contradictory to some of the Picard holder agreement provisions. So, for example, the Picard holder agreement says, you will not make purchases for others on your Picard. So it conflicts right away with that super user concept. We hope that there is light on at the end of the tunnel on the Picard. We appreciate how flexible it makes the whole community when they have to make instant purchases, and that in those cases, MMP, the protections and some of the ease that it affords actually is wasted on the kind of purchase that you are intent on making. And we recognize that, so we are entertaining discussions right now with six Picard providers, different banks. It has been 10 years since we entered the Picard program at McGill, in actually 11 years since 2002. And what we are seeing so far is that there are features of control and automation that really we are not benefiting from under the current program. Our contract with BMO expires in December of 2013. We might have to extend it a bit because this is not a kind of thing where you flick on a switch and just boom, 1,800 new P-cards are distributed. So there would be a transition period needed, assuming BMO does not offer themselves the same improvements to the Picard program. But as part of this, obviously, the Picard holder agreement, the concept of super user, the concept of profiles, user profiles being developed and worked into our Picard program at McGill will definitely be reviewed. Picard supporting documents, what is the recommendation? All available backup. It means if you have received the supplier quotes by email, by fax, on the web page that you have been shopping this purchase at, depending obviously on what the purchase value is. There are rules which I'm not an expert on exactly, but above $1,000 you will want to get two quotes, above $2,000 you will want to get three quotes, and so on. And I know that below 100, you find it, you can purchase it, basically. So, eligibility of purchase. So, obviously, we talked about granting agency rules. If you are about to make a purchase with a P-card using granting agency funding, make sure that the purchase you are about to make is legit. And it wouldn't hurt to just add the evidence of that to the P-card purchase that you will archive, the documentation that you will archive. The agreement, finally, on maybe the email sent by the professor that says to the supplier, okay, we will pay this amount and you will show up or you will deliver that part at that moment. A sales receipt and the actual invoice. Many suppliers do not only send the sales receipt of the transaction being processed, but actually send you an invoice with what are the details of what was purchased. And that is probably the most important part, and the part that plays the most into this. What we found out about is that BMO and other Picard providers actually have these systems. For BMO, it's called Details Online, in which when someone makes a P-card transaction, the equivalent of the sales receipt is loaded inside the details online system. This is not something that a feature that is turned on at McGill right now. So it would alleviate to a certain degree the paperwork that we have to deal with. But more interestingly is all of the suppliers that provide, I think it's called commodity 4 level, I think it's commodity level 4, visibility into what was purchased, it's the equivalent of the invoice. So if we can find a way to pull that information into the details online, the P-card becomes much less cumbersome to use. And the accountability, the traceability to the expense would be there. So we are exploring that as part of our discussions. Why does MMP encumber more taxes than what will be charged to the fund? As a result, this lowers the PI's spending power. Agreed. Banner currently cannot encumber taxes less rebates. It does not pre-calculate this. Why? Well, first of all, it is a future feature upgrade presented on the financial services roadmap. It's part of a Banner customization. It was meant for an October 2013 upgrade, but last peek at that roadmap shows it as an October 2014 upgrade. So please don't hold your breath. Banner is a U.S. product, and most universities are tax-exempt in the States. Tax rebates are a Canadian concept. Procurement system administrator can now process a change order that will correct the change order before it goes out to the actual encumbrance that you should be seeing. So if it's a tax-less purchase, she would be able to remove it. She would also be able to push the purchase order through with only the appropriate taxes, a tax minus the tax rebate. So it's a very manual thing, but it's a feature, and if you feel it's important, it's critical to your purchase, please do contact feedback, and we will address it through this change order mechanism until October 2014. Did I say 15? Yeah. Which taxes are, I'm sorry? Which taxes are charged to the fund and how are these taxes assessed? Both GST and QST are encumbered to the fund. The PO sent to the supplier will now show the amount based on the supplier code. So if the supplier is US based and he does not collect GST or QST, is not registered as collecting either, but he is coded as a tax-free supplier, or he's a small trader and coded as a tax-free supplier. Since January, MMP will now push the order, and I think that was a question you had asked last year, Marlene, if I'm not mistaken, but the purchase order goes out now with the appropriate amount shown so that the supplier will not overbill you. It's it's a $1,000 purchase, and he gets a purchase order for $1,150. Well, now he gets a purchase order at $1,000 because he won't see those taxes, correct. Taxes will be assessed and remitted to governments by McGill, so encumbrance is necessary. What's the play with those taxes? How do they get applied? Well, a purchase in Quebec for goods and services, both GST and QST, will usually, 99.4% of the time, not for services of small traders, however. There's a trick to that. Sorry, once again. Small traders, when their total revenue from all their sources, so not McGill alone, but from all sources, goes beyond $30,000, they have to register for that 1 year because otherwise they will be penalized by tax law. So at that point, their supplier coding would change. We would see that the amount paid by McGill alone has exceeded $30,000 in the calendar year, mind you, not in our fiscal year. In their calendar year, has exceeded $30,000. We would contact the supplier and ask him for his registration number. Purchases outside Quebec but in Canada for goods and services. GST and QST, again, apply. I'm always talking about these purchases being made out, but with the intent of using them here in Quebec. So I've not covered in the presentation purchases made outside of Quebec for use in the States, for use in South America, for use up north in Alaska or something. Or in Antarctica, as was the case last year. Purchase outside of Quebec, but in Canada for goods and services. So GST and QST are both assessed again. The registration of certain U.S. suppliers allows them to perceive and remit the GST and sometimes the QST to the governments. And at that stage, they would be coded as such in MMP. The purchase order would go out with the right amounts, the tax, and so we wouldn't have to worry about the difference at play with the tax and tax rebates. And anything further being assessed by accounts payable when the payment is processed. Purchases outside of Canada for goods. So if the goods need custom clearance, typically they are charged GST by the supplier. QST is generally then assessed by McGill at the time of payment and remitted to the government. Purchases outside of Canada for services, well, they are obviously not declared through customs, so GST and QST are fully assessed by McGill. For tax rebate, to what type of purchases are tax rebates applied? Are there purchases for which they are not applied? And are there different tax rebate rates? So to put it as simply as possible, all purchases on which taxes were remitted are eligible for tax rebates. McGill applies for rebates for all its purchases, but the results are increasingly erratic from MMP to P-card to expense reimbursement, as obviously we lose more and more of the visibility of whether or not this was a purchase on which taxes should have been applied or not, and it goes with the quality of the record and the burden of finding out. A few purchases are tax exempt. Rebate is then 100% of remitted taxes. I have asked for a list of what those tax exemptions are. Apparently, it's difficult to distribute one because the minute it's been distributed, it's obsolete. But I have asked for it, and I will transmit it to Brenda when I receive it for distribution to all of you. For subcontracts, when is it appropriate to go through procurement versus the Office of Sponsored Research? Procurement services, really little confusion when it regards goods and equipment, and foremost services. Facilities project management for construction and renovation projects. But there is a gray area that subsists. Good news is the proverbial puck is not dropped. What I mean by that is we are in touch with Nathan Currier's team, and I guess I would say when in doubt, do reach out to OSR. They're working along the same kind of guidelines and navigating in those gray areas. We have been asked for the better, I guess maybe 10, 12 months ago also to come up with a simple straight line response to that question. But the more we try and make that line straight, the more it curves on us to one side or the other. So I think it's a matter really of being very at ease communicating with either Procurement Services or Office of Sponsored Research to find out. Payments related to sub-agreements, payment requests versus POs. Well, I think we covered the payment requests pretty much to its fullest extent. So here's my little 2 cents on it. Procurement value services platform. Okay, so give me one more minute for some advertising. An upcoming services offering platform at Procurement Services. We're very proud of I think we'll trademark this. Verify compliance. That's already something that our team is pretty well trained to do. We have most of the reporting tools we need to do that. We want to help accentuate the quality of your purchases, getting the right terms and conditions in place, and with the right level of requirements in the call for tender, not making any compromise so that the minimum quality, lowest price approach continues to haunt us in the way it has in the beginning of its application. We want to leverage efficiency, repeat what works well, and abandon what doesn't and jump to new ideas. and undertake cost reductions. Obviously, that 3 or 4% that we currently do with the tools we have can make a big difference in certain units and departments' lives. Q&A, question and answers. Questions, maybe answers, we'll see.
I don't have a question necessarily, but I wanted to add to your OSR
yes.
versus procurement. So while Nathan isn't here, there's two things that I wanted to say. We, from our perspective in OSR, in regards to the taxes, I would say for those of you who are working at the pre-award application stages or who are helping PIs develop budgets or talk to your colleagues, we find that the PIs often will forget about the tax issues. They're not taking it into consideration. They're not budgeting for them. And I'm sure that you're seeing it at a post-award level because basically the funds aren't there to pay for those taxes. So I often tell the PIs, pretty much consider them always. So mm-hmm. the only time apart from personnel, put them in, and if they're not applicable, then those funds do become available for potentially other type of costs.
It's a good rule of thumb. That's also what we recommend in most cases.
Exactly. And as for the subcontract, if we are going to issue a subcontract in OSR to a for-profit entity, even though OSR has issued the sub and we've signed on a subcontract, it still has to go through MMP and a PO still has to be created. And so I know that that has caused some confusion. So in the past, we didn't have to do that, but we do now have to do it. So if your PI does come to you with a fully signed subcontract to a for-profit entity and then wants to pay them via a payment request, it's not going to go through. Mm-hmm. They do still have to do a PO. So I just wanted to
yes.
clarify that.
That was for creation of the encumbrance on on the fund, yes. Going once, going twice. It actually feels like an auction. So,
so will you? So for PIs that do the taxes get encumbered,
yes.
full taxes,
yes.
and sometimes it does happen that that causes a loss, a significant
yes.
loss
yes.
in spending power. We can direct them back to procurement.
To feedback, and then I think right now it's only Suzanne that has access, but soon Crystal will get the access to the same feature, and she'll be able to reduce the encumbrance to what it should be after the tax rebate has come in.
Okay, that's fantastic. Kay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Turn this off. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you to the speakers, Debbie and Francois, for coming in on busy schedule. And don't forget to fill out the online survey, please, and let us know your feedback. And have a nice weekend, everyone.
So you have the electronic version in your email box
yes.
if you want to.